And it's all about finance in the first hour with Karen Bobka, senior partner, a financial consultant at Holborn Assets, alongside our producer of Dubai Today, that is Joe McKibben. Hello to you, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello, good to see you. And we're going to take a look at life cover today. Life cover and protecting your family, and asking, is it critical? So we are intrigued by this. We've got Joe McKibben here, mum of three. Life cover, we imagine, when you're buying property, you'll get your life cover that way. But bringing in the family as well into the equation.
It's really important. I mean, the question that I'm asking is, you know, is it critical? And I could just say yes, and that's the end of the show and job done. But we can go into a little bit more detail than that, I think. It is so incredibly important, and I think it's possibly the most important thing that I do on a day-to-day basis, is to put mechanisms in place to protect the family in the event that something goes wrong, in the event that someone dies, that someone is severely ill or disabled. Those are the things that we need to be considering before we think about the long-term savings, before we think about the retirement planning. It's the what could go wrong tomorrow. That should always be our focus if we're doing proper holistic planning for people.
So where are we currently then? How are we looking here in the UAE as individuals or families when it comes to life cover?
Oh, we've got a long way to go. I mean, I don't know what the actual statistics are. It might be interesting to perhaps try and find out, I guess. But I do have figures from elsewhere. So I've managed to find online information from the UK and the US. Now, these are relatively recent, so I think these are broadly accurate. And for the UK, it's estimated that one in four breadwinners do not have any life insurance. Now, that's any life insurance. So in the UK, in most cases, you are not obligated, not legally obliged to have life cover with a mortgage. So many people don't do that because they don't have to. So they haven't got that. They haven't got anything in place at all. In the US, the figures are that 30% don't have a life policy. So quite similar, really. Those are quite worrying statistics, I think.
What happens if, you know, the worst happens and you were to have an accident, be debilitated, not able to work, or worse, die? What happens to your mortgage if you don't have life cover?
Generally, the debt has to be paid still. That's the thing. So often a property may have to be sold in order to meet that particular obligation, or other savings in cash to meet that. And that could leave your family, your children, in the literal dire straits, because there's nothing there. They may not have a roof over their head. That's quite a scary prospect. And I think sometimes we do have to put some fear into people about what could happen, because these things do happen.
Joe, you've been looking at some stories on this.
Yes, I mean, just I'm sitting here listening to what you're saying, Karen. And just last week, there was a survey released by Aviva, who are the British insurance company. And, you know, in theory, having insurance to protect your family against loss of life or critical illness is a thoroughly good idea. However, it found that just 40% of respondents think the insurance will actually pay out when this sort of policy is claimed against. And they say that one in every two Britons effectively think that life insurance is worthless. They also think, surprise, surprise, that the insurance will always try and avoid paying out. So why the disconnect? And Aviva think that people are ill-informed and that the industry should work to try and get rid of this myth that claims frequently go unpaid. And the reason people think insurers don't pay is because they probably know someone who has either had a claim denied or who has endured a bad experience before getting one paid. And that, and here as well, they're saying it's not just life insurance. It's calling any insurer about a claim on any policy can be a thoroughly miserable experience.
So that might be one reason why people aren't taking it.
Yes, it is. Now, I want to refute that completely, because insurance companies are not bad at paying out claims for life policies or for critical illness cover. Certainly not for life policies. There's a procedure that has to be gone through. So there have to be death certificates provided. There may be questions asked depending on circumstances. If something arises that was a pre-existing condition that was not disclosed in an application, that, however, is very rare when it comes to life policies. Now, I think this is worth something that actually addressing properly, because I think the experience that most people have of making a claim on insurance policy is with things like home contents, motor insurance. Now, those are not as black and white as being dead or alive, are they? Let's be honest about it. So there's a lot more questions asked, and I think we also know that there are many people who have tried to claim on things for buildings and contents insurance that they maybe should not have done. now, and that's where the insurers know that people will try and, let's say, exaggerate claims a little bit. So hence they will ask a lot of questions. But these are very, very different disciplines. They are very different arms of the business and work quite differently. And some, you know, one's rather more important than the other. So absolutely, that you should never have a concern that a life policy would not be paid out unless for some reason you have not disclosed things.
And I think that's it. I think it's about filling out the form properly. And ultimately, you know, the insurance is still sold by the same people. It's something that's sold, and it's a difficult process to go through with filling in those forms. So let's not go to death. You go critical illness. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the grey area is. And I think that's what people are saying. It's like, I had this in this cover for critical illness, and then I got cancer, and I didn't say on my form that I had this, and so I'm not receiving the payout.
Right. Okay, well, when you fill something in, you really must be honest. And any advisor, and you should be working with someone who understands the whole setup properly, should explain to you what you should be disclosing. You're better off doing that and being properly covered. Now, there's also, I think, a lot of misunderstanding as to what critical illness policies do and don't cover. Now, the main things that people claim from here are heart disease, stroke, and cancer. But it's degrees of. Now, cancer is generally, I mean, there are so many different forms of cancer as well. There's sort of the stage ones up to the stage four in most cases. Most stage one cancers are very curable if they're discovered properly and treated properly. Those will generally not be covered by a policy. If you think about it, if someone was able to claim for any illness, that means there would be far more claims, and that would put the premiums up dramatically. So the policies, and the clue is in the name here, are for critical illnesses. Things that are, that could be terminal, are very serious. So if someone just has a minor heart murmur, you're not going to get a claim for that because that is relatively minor and treatable. But if you have the full-on heart attack and it ticks the boxes and it's made quite clear, then claims will be made. Now, I've actually brought with me a bit of a booklet.
Well, when we come back, we'll go through the booklet with Karen Bobcutt, really understanding what it is that you're filling in when you do go to the live cover form and critical illness, understanding exactly what you can claim for. So really not just doing it, paying the money and not asking the right questions. So yeah, more to come on this, more of understanding live cover for you, your family, and is it critical? That's what we're asking. People are texting in as well, one here, what qualifications should we expect from a person offering or advising us on life insurance? Good question. We'll address that and more when we come back. And talking to Karen Bobcutt, she's senior partner with Hobben Assets, financial consultant, alongside Joe McKibben, producer of Dubai Today, and looking at life cover for your family. Is it critical? Now, expat in Dubai has messaged in to say, what qualifications should we expect from a person offering or advising us on life insurance?
Well, difficult one, really. It depends on what work the person is doing, what their background is and what country they come from. But I think the point is that you would expect someone to have a decent level of qualifications, actually have some bits of paper to prove that they've taken their profession seriously. Qualifications aren't everything in this industry. Experience and knowledge counts for a lot. But I think having some proper paper qualification shows that you are serious about it.
But it also gives validation, doesn't it, Karen?
It absolutely
because
does.
Somebody can say, I've got great experience and I was amazing in my home country. But if there's nothing to trace that, we're trusting the word.
Absolutely. Right. So the main body in the UK is the Chartered Insurance Institute. So you'd expect to see CII qualifications. The other one we see quite often here is the CISI. There's different ones for the US, and I can't remember their regulatory body. But the thing is to ask someone. And if that person then becomes evasive and won't tell you things, I suggest that might be a reason to conclude that meeting. Because if someone has a proper level of qualifications, they'll be very happy to tell you about it. They'll show you the certificates, and you can find the information often online. As what they actually have.
Well, we'll talk a little bit later. I want to understand more about initial stages of live cover, but we might look at later as well some of those pitfalls to look out for maybe in policies if you're signing up and paying for live cover. But look, let's just start again. Who needs live cover? Let's just establish that first.
Right. in many cases, the majority of people probably do. But let's go through a bit of a list then. So anyone who's got a financial obligation, so a mortgage or a debt, often arranging a mortgage in the UAE, life cover will come with that. That is for the lender's benefit. It pays off the mortgage. It is not for the benefit of your family, however. Again, if you do not have a mortgage, but you have substantial debts, you may want to consider having a policy to cover those, because in the event of your death, they don't disappear. They have to be paid. If you have dependents, so if you have a dependent spouse, you have children, I would say it's a no-brainer that you need something in place just in case, so that they've got funds in the event of your demise. So that's often the main breadwinner. And I think it's sort of understood, yes, the person who brings the main income into the house should have insurance.
So it doesn't mean that both partners.
Well, I think both partners should. So I think what often happens, and I'm going to sound horribly sexist here, but who cares? A lot of male advisors particularly will look at the traditional families, and we see a lot of them here, woman at home with children, the stay-at-home mum, and the man out working, and would be concerned about insuring him because he brings in an income, and forgets the value that the woman or the non-working spouse, because it does happen the other way around, actually brings into the home. And that person should also be insured. Because if they're taken out of the equation, not only is there the person who looks after the children and the home care got to be considered, but the main breadwinner may want to take some time off work themselves and reorganise their life and spend it with their children. And that goes for both parties. So what we're talking about is a quality of life issue with the life insurance, not the money exactly, but what it does for you. Moving on from that, business owners and key employees. If you have a business that's dependent on a handful of employees, and your business could have problems if that person dies or is seriously ill, there are steps you can take for your business to receive an income or a lump sum to potentially replace that. So that's what's something that's, I think, not talked about anywhere near enough in this country, and we should be talking to employers about that as well. The other one, we don't see it so much here, is people wanting life cover to consider inheritance tax issues. If they've got a major liability on death and they would prefer to have a plan in place to pay taxes rather than assets to be sold. So there's a whole list of different areas. If you're single and you don't have dependents, you probably don't need life cover. But what you ought to be considering is something that protects you, and that's critical illness cover. So if you're ill or you're unable to work for an extended period because of serious ill health, or you're disabled, you will receive the benefits of that plan. So not the death benefit, you're not worried about that, but to protect yourself.
The book you've got with you there?
Well, this little book, I mean, the insurance companies all issue their own guides to critical illness cover, which we were talking about before the break there. And coming back to Joe's point about people saying things won't pay out. Well, you should be given the paperwork that explains the criteria for claims to be met. And if you're not, again, you should have concerns and you should be asking for it. But it is, you know, behoving on the individual to read these things through and understand the parameters. Now, I don't want to go into this in great detail because it's really quite joyless. But it covers
Well, you said it, Karen. It hence is. Why people don't read the book, right?
But some of it's in quite big font. So just skim through that, if nothing
but
else.
But that's going back to what Aviva was saying with their survey. Aviva complained that 30% of people admit to cheating on insurance forms, and they shouldn't. And they say, however, there is the process of applying for protection policies. Yeah. It is highly intrusive and very unpleasant. And policy documents often contain a lot of legalese, even in efforts, the after efforts have been made to make key features easier to understand. The fact is that you do need somebody to hand hold
yes.
you filling out this very intrusive form about your
completely.
Physical health and well-being.
But at least then you get it done, wouldn't you? Because yeah. Let's
then
be honest.
Pay for it.
Yeah, I know. There's two things there, exactly. The two things why we're not doing it. One, you know, and amongst a few others, but actually in a busy life where we seem to be paying out left, right and centre for this, that and the other, and we get, you know, worried about this, that and the other, and that's going to drop right down to the bottom of many people's lists, because one, it's a chore, it's intrusive, and it's more money I've got to pay out for something.
Right. Okay, 2 points there. Right, the paperwork, yeah, it is a bit of a pain. But that's why I will never, ever send someone a form to fill in. They are always going to sit down with me because I have the great pleasure of getting my black pen out and marking through huge sections that often are not relevant.
Good.
And I will
explain.
It's very joyful, that bit. And I will explain to people how to complete things and what questions are relevant and what the answers should be. And I don't mean I'm coaching them, but when there's questions like, you know, how long are you going to remain in the country? The answer is invariably indefinitely because we don't know. And it's little things with knowing what to put in. And when forms ask about travelling, often if it's just across the GCC countries, you don't necessarily have to list all of them. You can just say GCC. And it's just making it a little bit easier and knowing how to answer and what information is required. It is a nuisance, but it has got a little better because many people now don't have to go for full medicals. They can just have a nurse screening as well.
Okay. Good question here from Spencer regarding life insurance. Why is it a lot higher in the UAE than the UK for a similar policy? We'll ask Karen on that when we come back. Yeah, Karen Bobkas here. It's your monthly look at your personal finances with us here on Dubai Today. Jo McKibben's here as well, producer of the show. Karen, you can find her in various media outlets. On Your Side is her column in the national newspaper, also her blog at Financial UAE, and she's with us every month. And we're talking today about protecting your family. Is it critical through life cover? And of course, here to take any questions that you're concerned about to do with your personal finances. And many of you are texting in today with a lot of different issues. Let me just share this one with you, Karen, from Vincent, who called us earlier saying, I have an amount of money that is kept in the bank and I've always been told it's good to have liquidity. But now I'm wondering, is it better to take that money and invest it in property or in a mutual fund? Is it being wasted sitting in the bank?
Right. That depends very much on his circumstances and what access he requires and when he wants funds. Everyone needs to keep a certain amount of money in the bank that they can access in case of emergency. So the emergency fund that we talk about on a regular basis. But in most cases, that needs to be 3 to 6 months worth of outgoings. Above that, then he can certainly look at investing. But what's right for him depends on the time frame, his views on risk, his circumstances, how long he's going to remain in the UAE. So it's a case of sitting down and going through those different factors once he's, you know, earmarked the emergency monies and what's available after that.
When we're back on topic regarding insurance, as in personal cover, life cover, question here about why is it more expensive in the UAE than it is in the UK for a similar policy?
Okay, it is what it is to a certain extent. Right, there's several factors that come into play here. There is the running of an offshore insurance company and having offices here and in places like the Isle of Man. That's obviously a main place for the insurance companies that we deal with here. There is the fact that many policies do not continue through to maturity and the costs are borne at outset by the insurance company. More people here smoke than they do back in our home countries, and it's to do with occupations and lifestyles as well. We often have people here in what are considered slightly more dangerous occupations, so people working in oil and gas, for example. We have fatalities on the roads here are much higher than they are, for example, in the UK or the US or Northern Europe. So that's factored into the equation. The insurance companies all share information regarding claims that are made and at what age, and then work out an average. And that's how the costs are actually calculated by them. But those are the main reasons why, I'm afraid. And it is what it is. We find the best of what's available on all the different companies that we deal with.
And Karen, are you able to give a ballpark? You are this age. You are male, you are healthy, you've passed your nurse screening, etc., etc., you've filled out all the forms. This is your ballpark monthly repayment figure.
Approximately, yeah. So let's say you're, and I don't have a lot of numbers with me today, but you're a man and you're 35 years old and you're relatively fit and healthy.
You don't smoke.
And you want to cover for, say, $1 million, nice round number. That is likely to cost you something, and this is over a 20-year period as well. That's probably going to cost you around 180 dirhams a month.
Okay.
It's not an awful lot. If, however, you are a smoker, and that includes an occasional smoker and someone who smokes shisha, that premium is likely to increase to something like 260 dirhams.
What if you're a previous smoker, you used to smoke?
You have to have quit for a full 12 months.
Okay.
And if that's the case, then you can have the non-smoker rates. For pure life cover, the costs for women are generally a little bit less. Not hugely different, but maybe 10%, 15% lower, because women live a little bit longer and tend to be more cautious in the way that they live.
So presumably then, obviously, as you get older, if you're claiming in your 50 or over, that's going to increase that number in theory.
Well, for most life assurance plans, for a term assurance policy, and on the article that goes with this on my website today, that the differences are explained. For a simple term assurance policy that's pure life cover, your premiums will be guaranteed for the duration, assuming you don't make any drastic changes to your lifestyle and don't decide to take up smoking. So those premiums are fixed. So if you take out a policy now and you're 35, those premiums will not change until you're aged 55.
Another question here. Doesn't the insurance taken out by the bank on a loan pay for the balance should something happen to you, you know, what you took out with the loan? So it's already included, that insurance.
It is. It covers the mortgage. So the mortgage gets paid off. As I said earlier, this is for the benefit of the bank to make sure that their debt is met and they're not left with anything. It is not for the benefit of you. It is not for the benefit of your family. So yes, that's good. You know, you may not need to have a separate policy for the mortgage, but if you've got dependents and family, then you should look at something else that you will benefit from.
Just to clarify again regarding women, if you're married and your husband is the main wage earner, you were saying that it's still advisable for women to have cover as well. But why? Just to clarify.
Because, well, if there's children there, then to perhaps give them an inheritance and something to fall back on, and to give some choices and options to the other party. Just because a woman is not in paid employment, it doesn't mean that her functions don't have value. To assume that they don't, I think, is a very old-fashioned view. And when I'm speaking with people, I will always ask if they want to do that. Sometimes they tell me that they do not want to, and I will make a note of that. But I think it should be arranged for them. It may well be that a lower amount is required, but it does mean that the husband then gets a payout that allows him to go, right, shall I, you know, spend a year with my family? What do I want to do? If you've got grown-up children, you have other assets, you may not have the same requirement for it, but it's always something that I'd want to talk about.
You can see the article on Karen's blog, Financial UAE. Life cover for your family, is it critical? What else do we need to be aware of? What might be some of the pitfalls, again, with policies that are out there, making sure we're getting the right policy for us?
Well, there's a number of things to consider. I mean, what currency are you arranging the plan in? You can set one up in UAE dirhams. I would suggest, however, that for most people, it's actually better to look at US dollars, because you can pay those premiums in dirhams, so it's the same coming out of your pocket. But that could be more beneficial to you if you leave the UAE and go somewhere else, with the US dollar being a major currency compared to us. We're a slightly smaller fish when it comes to that kind of thing. It's understanding what you are covered for. It's understanding that the term is right, whether you should be looking at a whole of life plan or a term policy. For most people, a term plan is what's required. It's the sort of the pay-as-you-go cover. It's the cheaper version. Better value for money might be a better way of putting it, and it covers a need, because I would hope that at the same time you are building up savings and assets for the future, so you shouldn't be needing it at a later date.
So can you just explain what the difference is between permanent and term life insurance?
A term policy is for a specific period. When you apply for the cover, you say how many years you want it for, whether that's 10, 15, 20, 25. Often it's until your children are going to be financially independent.
So not with those millennials.
30 years, who knows?
Never.
Let's assume early 20s. Let's be optimistic. At least they can go and get a job then anyway. So it's for a specific period of time. Generally, if it's life cover only, the premiums are guaranteed. It's pay as you go. If you stop paying the premiums, the cover goes. There isn't anything to come back. It's a bit like motor insurance. You don't expect any money back for that, do you, for your car insurance? You pay as you go. It's that kind of thing. The alternative is a thing called a whole of life plan, which can be designed to go for the duration of your life. It's a lot more expensive, however, if you're going to be insured for longer. It has its place in planning. I think it's frequently missold as also a savings plan, but it's not designed for that. It's designed to build up a value within the policy that is then used to offset premiums at a later date. And I really don't like a combination product. I don't think it does either job properly. But again, that's a discussion to have with clients each time.
One question here about leaving the UAE in the next few months. I'm British, moving to Spain. What would you recommend regarding where I transfer my funds in light of Brexit, etc.?
Ooh, well, then it's a consideration of is Spain going to be the permanent home? Is the money going to be required in euros? Probably an offshore bank account would be a smart place to put it. And because you can have the money there in multiple currencies, so you can have your accounts in dollars, so that's kind of same as dirhams if you like, in euros, in sterling, and you can move between them as and when suits you based on the exchange rate. As to how that might change in the future with Brexit and the UK election, I think many of these things have already been factored in. Unless we get the result that we're not expecting. Don't like to predict after all the political outcomes of the last year or so. Putting the money offshore and then working out what's the best view at any point in time is probably best.
Karen Bobkus here, senior partner with Holborn Assets, and she joins us every month alongside Joe McKibben, who joins us every day, producer of Dubai Today. We've been looking at life cover and protecting your family and exploring whether it's critical or not. We've got some more questions on that. Also, Karen, you wanted to share a bit of info about mortgages at the moment for Brits.
Just very, very quickly, because obviously it's not really today's topic, but we've got a new mortgage product I think that will be of interest to quite a lot of people. For anyone buying in the UK as an expat, for a long time, there has been a minimum mortgage value that you've had to apply for of $100,000 based on a property value or purchase price of $150,000. And from time to time, I come across people who want to buy in a cheaper area, an investment property, and it just doesn't fit. And these have been the lender's rules because it's not been economic, but we now have a new lender to the market who is looking to pick up smaller mortgages. And so now we can arrange mortgages for expats with a minimum of £30,000 only on a minimum purchase price of £80,000. Now, the caveat here, I'm afraid, is it's for British nationals only. So British expats buying in the UK. But if anyone is looking for a lower, a cheaper property, an investment property, we can now do those smaller mortgages. It is a Sharia compliant mortgage, but at the end of the day, you won't really see any different. It's a good product with good interest rates. So worth having a chat if that's of interest to you.
On life cover, somebody asking a good question here. Can we have a combined policy to cover both life and health?
Absolutely, you can. Well, you can have it combined. So it's life assurance, critical illness cover, and something called total permanent disability, which pays out if you are permanently incapacitated. So you can have combinations of the levels. So you can have a much higher level of life cover and a small amount of critical illness. And it's a case of working out what works for the person in terms of their lifestyle and their budget as well.
Question here. My question is not related to insurance. However, I would like to ask for your financial advice. I have 4 credit cards with a total debt of 60,000 dirhams. I'm making monthly minimum payments and little extra. I'm thinking of applying for a personal loan and paying the credit card debt off and then make monthly installments towards the loan. What would you advise regarding taking a loan, or should I take a loan, or should I continue making those minimum monthly payments towards the credit cards?
Right. First of all, anyone that makes the minimum payments on a credit card is never going to pay off the debt. All you're doing there is paying the interest and nothing else. So that's a long road. It's always going to be there. Are they able to make larger payments and pay it off? In the grand scale of things, that's not a big amount of debt, not compared to the numbers that I see on a regular basis. If they are able to significantly increase the payments and get them paid off over the space of a year, I'd be inclined to stick with that. If that is not the case and they can find a personal loan where that they can comfortably afford the payments over not too long a period, that means that they can pay off the debt. There is an argument for doing that, but they need to cut up the credit cards. They need to not use them again, because what I see is people doing the consolidation loan thing, pay off the cards, and then it's like, temptation. I have a credit card. I have a credit limit. And that's a cycle of debt that becomes quite ridiculous and you can't get out of. So that's the concern there.
Another question. I work in marketing and I've just been made redundant and I've been given a 30 days notice to leave. It's looking like I might not get my gratuity. I'm in shock and not sure what best to do next. Do I stay or do I leave? I have a small amount of savings but don't want to eat into those. I've got 3 months left on my rental, on my lease, on my apartment. So difficult position
okay.
for somebody.
Why will they not get their gratuity? If they're made redundant and they've been there over a year, they are entitled to an end of service gratuity. That's the fact. That's law. If they were resigning and they were on a fixed term contract, that's something else. It depends on what contract they're on.
What if they don't have the money? What if they don't?
If the employer doesn't have the money, well, that's always a problem, isn't it? Is that you can't make money out of money. But if they're just saying they're not paying them, there's a good case to raise a case with the Labour Department there. And follow that up. And they are very good at helping people. Now, if they're getting, you know, a month's income, and if they get some gratuity, and their rent's paid, then maybe they want to be looking for a new job if that's possible. But I have seen a lot of people hang on here for way too long in the expectation that something will come up, and all that happens is that they accrue debt and put themselves in a very sticky situation.
On that note, of course, you have the debt panel, and also on Dubai, on, you know, with the national newspaper, and obviously we're hearing just last week the Business Breakfast running, similar, looking at the health of our finances in the UAE economically. We cover it quite a lot on The Couch when it comes to mental illness, and I saw that one of your columns actually was about somebody who was suffering from mental illness. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Right, there's a chap, and it was their brother or sister, I think, that contacted the debt panel at the National. This person owes, I think it was $91,000 from memory, trying to remember the exact sum here. And they are in jail for non-payment of the debt. But the person has serious mental issues. The bank is not lifting the police case until monies are paid. There's no money to pay at the moment. And so we have this stalemate. And the question was, what can we do? Well, that was probably one of the hardest ones I've had to deal with, because I would love to see that the bank in this particular situation would go, okay, let's come to some agreement with the family. Maybe the family can pay a small amount or some money towards the debt. We'll release the person, allow them to go and get some medical treatment, and then have an arrangement for monies to be repaid, and hope that the bank's faith in that person is repaid literally with the money that's owed. And sometimes I think the banks have to be the bigger person. I don't know the circumstances of why the person got into debt. Often it's because someone is, I'm afraid, foolish in terms of what they've borrowed. And it's there's some really hard situations that we come across that there aren't solutions. But in this one, it's up to the bank, I think.
Mm-mm. More questions, Jo?
Yes, here's an interesting one. Last night, I withdrew a large sum of money from an ATM. It reduced my balance but didn't cough up the cash, although it did provide me with a cancelled transaction receipt. When I called the customer service number, they told me I had to go online, download a claim form to complete it by hand, scan it in, email it back to them so that they can process the claim and look at it tomorrow once they have investigated. What is that all about?
That's fairly standard practice, because some people lie. Someone may have had the money out and have said that they haven't, and that has happened. So hence the banks have a procedure that they will go through. And generally they will look into that and they will deal with it. If your bank is not dealing with that situation, in some cases I can help, or it's a case you can raise with the central bank. But that's fairly standard practice, I'm afraid, because the few dishonest people amongst us make it harder for those of us that are on it. Unfortunate, and it's a bit of a lousy situation to be in.
Karen Bobka, thank you very much for your time as always. Off to join the debt panel, I believe, for more questions and filming. So we'll look with interest what happens there. You can check out Karen. She has her column with the National Newspaper on your side. Also, her blog. Go online. There's more to the live cover. There's lots of interesting articles and there to help you. Financial UAE is her blog. Thank you to Jo, of course. Thank you.